Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series with Issue 25. The economy is or isn't rigged. It's hardly a new debate, Thomas Jefferson.
But Hamilton forgets his plan would have the government assume state sense. Now place your bets as to who that benefits. The very seat of government where Hamilton sits.
Not true. Oh.
Hamilton hits back.
A civics lesson from a slaver. Hey, neighbor, your debts are paid because you don't pay for labor. We plant seeds in the South. We create. They keep ranting. We know who's really doing the planting.
So who was rigging the economy in those founding father days? The New York bankers who wanted a national debt like Hamilton, or the slavers, as Hamilton called Jefferson, at least in the Broadway version of history? Maybe both sides were trying to rig it in their own ways. In 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt became president, he didn't use the word rigged, but he reformed the economic system that he felt was channeling American prosperity into fewer and fewer hands.
My friends, I still believe in ideals. I am not for a return to that definition of liberty under which for many years a free people were being gradually regimented into the service of the privileged few. I prefer, and I am sure you prefer, that broader definition of liberty under which we are moving forward to greater freedom, to greater security for the average man than he has ever known before in the history of America.
FDR, from one of his fireside radio chats in 1933, thank you, Herbert Hoover. All right, back to Broadway, and we'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover, from the musical Annie, kind of making the same point. So flash forward to 1984, Ronald Reagan's re-election. His across-the-board tax cuts had helped a broad-based economic recovery get off the ground, but Democrat Walter Mondale ran this campaign ad against him. The sound of this old clip is not great, but it's Mondale arguing that Reaganomics was also Rigonomics for the people at the top.
Over the last 3 years, those making $200,000 a year got a $60,000 tax break. Thousands of profitable corporations paid no taxes.
I refuse to make your family pay more so that millionaires can pay less.
This is the debate. Fairness. Will we all pay our fair share? Mondale will close tax loopholes and simplify the tax code. Mondale Ferraro, fighting for our future.
A Walter Mondale campaign spot from 1984. Then came the recession of the George H.W. Bush years and the boom of the Bill Clinton years, despite or maybe helped by a tax hike on the rich. Then the tech bubble burst and a collection of corporate scandals further damaged millions of workers. The biggest scandal involving the energy company Enron in 2001. Enron collapsed after getting caught rigging its own books. This after being a massive campaign donation force for more than a decade and winning exemptions from federal oversight. Here is Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman in 2002 announcing an investigation into what happened.
More than 5,000 of its 21,000 employees have been laid off, and many more have lost much or all of their retirement savings because half of Enron's 401k plan was invested in the company's own now worthless stock. The suddenness with which this company fell is shocking. It was in the top 10 in largest companies in the country. Even the savviest experts on Wall Street were apparently blindsided when a $77 billion company loses nearly all of its market value and plunges into bankruptcy in a matter of weeks, to the surprise apparently of everyone, including those whose business it is to know better. The public's confidence in the stock market is shaken.
Including those whose business it is to know better, Senator Lieberman said at the end of that. Congress had taken itself out of that business where Enron and its auditor, Arthur Anderson, were concerned to too large a degree. Enron had given campaign donations to about 75 U.S. senators and was the biggest donor to George W. Bush over his entire political career as they successfully lobbied for exemptions to financial regulation. Some might use the word rigged. Washington might have learned its lesson from Enron and Arthur Anderson after 2001, but as we know, deregulation of mortgage securities contributed mightily to the next financial crisis, the one we're still recovering from, when the housing bubble burst in 2008. In the movie The Big Short, the character Mark Baum, played by Steve Carell, and based on the real-life Wall Street trader Steve Eisman, saw the crash coming, placed big bets on it on Wall Street, and described the mortgage market in this monologue in terms of a rigged America.
We live in an era of fraud in America, not just in banking, but in government, education, religion, food, even baseball. What bothers me isn't that fraud is not nice or that fraud is mean. It's that for 15,000 years, fraud and short-sighted thinking have never, ever worked. Not once.
Jesus.
Eventually,
we're at 37.
People get caught. Like things go
plummeting, man. Plummeting.
When the hell did we forget all that? I thought we were better than this. I really did. And the fact that we're not doesn't make me feel all right and superior. It makes me feel sad. And as fun as it is to watch pompous, dumb Wall Streeters be wildly wrong, and you are wrong, sir, I just know that at the end of the day, average people are going to be the ones that are going to have to pay for all of this. Because they always, 32? Always do.
Steve Carell as Mark Baum, based on trader Steve Eisman in The Big Short from just last year. That broad sense that not just the mortgage market, but lots of things are rigged by too much corporate money in politics led to the Occupy movement, of course, in 2011. One of their supporters and one of their role models was Callie Lassen, founder of the magazine Adbusters.
And every day in our lives, you know, the food we eat and the medical attention we get and every aspect of our life is somehow controlled by mega corporations. And certainly brainstorming with occupiers in America, I have this feeling that you know, a soft regime change in America is something that a lot of people feel very strongly about.
Callie Lassen on NPR in 2012. You know who else saw the economy as rigged leading up to the financial crisis and after? Who might surprise you? Ronald Reagan's budget director, David Stockman. He had championed the theory of trickle-down economics to promote the Reagan tax cuts in the 80s, but blasted it as theory when applied by George W. Bush.
I find it unconscionable that the Republican leadership, faced with a $1.5 trillion deficit, could possibly believe that good public policy is to maintain tax cuts for the top 2% of the population, who, after all, have benefited enormously from this phony boom we've had over the last 10 years as a result of the casino on Wall Street. And I blame Paulson on it. I blame the Bush White House. They basically sold out the birthright of the Republican Party when they bailed out Wall Street unnecessarily in a state of complete panic in September 2008. That's really, at the end of the day, one of the greatest misfortunes in fiscal governance since the Reagan Revolution tried to straighten things out beginning in 1980.
David Stockman in an NPR interview in 2010. Here's an even more damning take on an even longer view of history of rigging the economy as seen through the eyes of Senator Elizabeth Warren. This, of course, is very identified with her in general, this topic. This is a minute and a half of Senator Warren in a National Press Club address last year reflecting on the last 80 years of history.
From 1935 to 1979, the 90% got about 70% of all income growth in the United States. Now, sure, the top 10% did better. They got a little more. But think about it this way. As the economic pie got bigger, pretty much everyone was getting a little bit more. And that's how this country built a great middle class. And then, in the early 1980s, a new theory swept the country. Its disciples claimed that if government policies took care of the rich and powerful, wealth would trickle down for everyone else. Trickle-down believers cut taxes sharply for those at the top, and to pay for it, they cut our investments in the future, our investments in education, our investments in roads, investments in energy, investments in research, investments that build opportunity. Trickle-down advocates also pushed for deregulation that hobbled the cops on Wall Street and let some of the most powerful corporations in this country do pretty much whatever they pleased. And what was the consequence? Well, remember the 90% that got 70% of all income growth from 35 to 1979? What happened from 1980 until 2012? Well, the answer is once trickle-down took hold, the 90% got left behind.
Elizabeth Warren in a National Press Club speech last year. And how about the word rigged, so prominent in the presidential campaign now? These days, there's sort of a liberal and a conservative view of rigged economics. There's the Elizabeth Warren view we just heard that uses the word rigged a lot. And there's the conservative view that prefers the term crony capitalism. Here's Mitt Romney on CBS during his 2012 campaign objecting to the Obama administration investing public money in the solar energy company Solyndra to try to help get the solar market off the ground. Solyndra went bust.
Oh, I think it's a conflict of interest of some magnitude to have an administration and a president take taxpayer money, $500 million of taxpayer money, and devote it to a business which is owned by major campaign contributors. That's a real problem. That's a conflict of interest. I mean, this is not a small number. This is $500 million, $500 million. And in the circumstance that the business were to do well, the president's friends would make a fortune. The taxpayers, however, get nothing. That's not the way that the government ought to be working.
Mitt Romney in 2012. But which is the bigger rigor of the economy? Government investments designed to push the economy toward the public interest, or government surrendering increasingly to market forces, allowing debacles like Enron and the mortgage crisis? That's an issue Trump and Clinton are hashing out, as they both say the economy is rigged. We'll hear the candidates in their own words on this tomorrow in this series, our 30 Issues election series, Issue 25, The Economy Is or Isn't Rigged. Right now, let's talk about some of the history we just heard with Yale political science professor Jacob Hacker, co-author of a new book, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. You may know his previous much-discussed book, The Winner-Take-All Economy. Hi, Professor Hacker. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me back, Brian.
Your take on history in your book kind of suggests that government used to play a role in unrigging the economy. Now it plays a role in rigging it. Would you put it that way?
Well, what I would say is, and this is the core theme of our most recent book, is that government is inevitably entwined with a strong market economy. The 20th century saw the rise of what is sometimes called the mixed economy, where government alongside the market helped ensure that the public interest and prosperity were protected. And the real issue, I think, and the issue that we wrote about in our last book, Winner Take All Politics, is that over the last generation, the kind of role that government has played has shifted much more toward helping out those at the top. And sometimes that's about doing specific things. You know, we heard about the tax cuts for the rich and corporations in this wonderful opening interlude. But sometimes it's about not doing anything at all or trying to cut back government's role, as in deregulation. Because, as I said, you know, markets are always shaped by government, and government can play a kind of constructive role in making sure that they provide equal opportunity and broad growth. Or government can play a destructive role, favoring certain sectors, favoring certain segments of society like the rich. And that's the debate, I think. It's not a debate over whether we should have a government. It's to some extent a debate over how active government should be, but fundamentally it's about who government should represent, whether in a democracy it should really be standing up for the broad American people, or whether or not it's really working on behalf of narrow interests.
Tomorrow we'll play clips of Trump and Clinton and Bernie Sanders all using the word rigged in their campaigns. Do you use the word, the actual word rigged, in your book?
We don't. And, you know, I think it's a word that that really does encapsulate a broad sense of, that Americans are feeling. But I'll come back to why I think it's also problematic. But you know, there was a poll that was done by Marketplace just a couple months ago, and they found that, you know, almost three-quarters of Americans said that the economy was rigged, and only about a quarter said that they thought it was providing fair outcomes. And so, and that was true of Republicans as well as Democrats. It was actually really true of younger Americans, who feel as if the economy is a kind of heads I win, tails you lose equation for them. And, you know, I think there's a lot of truth behind that. My concern is that when you talk about rigged, it's a kind of self-defeating position. The big argument that Paul Pearson and I made in Winner Take All Politics is that this inequality wasn't some kind of natural outgrowth of the market. It really reflected policy decisions our political leaders made. And when you start to talk about a rigged economy and a rigged politics, it can lead people to think that there's no way to change it. And that to me is the big problem. You know, a rigged dice, or, you know, a dice that's loaded, will never come up, or very rarely come up, on the on a fair outcome. And so that's what I worry about, is that people don't think you can change the underlying distortions of the political system and the economy that lead them to be so pessimistic.
You criticize Bill Clinton for his role in this progression in your book, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Clinton administration, the new Democrats that Bill Clinton represented, they were very much of the view that you should sort of let the market rip and then clean up afterwards, right? You know, if there was increased inequality and poverty that was a result of market forces, then, you know, that was an argument for doing more redistribution. And, you know, I think that really ignored the extent to which it was the decisions that were being made about the market, like deregulation, that were driving much of this inequality. And just, it's really difficult in a democratic society to say, let the chips fall where they may with the market, and then let's come in and we'll fix it all up. I mean, democracies generally respond to concentrated interests. They generally respond to money, and our democracy has become more responsive to money and concentrated interests. So that's, I think, pushing us to think more about, well, how can we make sure that the economic game isn't so tilted? And then, of course, that's going to require that our democracy is working better to represent broad, diffuse general interests rather than these concentrated interests and those at the very top.
Do you see Hillary Clinton evolving from that position?
Yeah, I think that she's definitely picked up this theme, and it was probably one of her most effective lines of attack on Trump in the debate. I think for a lot of people listening to Trump say, you know, it's good business not to pay taxes, and talking sort of incoherently, but I think generally about how we should give business and the wealthy more resources because they're the job creators. I think that did not play well with many Americans who feel as if what really needs to happen is we need to try to figure out how to get the middle class back on its feet. That said, I think, you know, it's not a program that can be solved through a bunch of policy ideas, though those are important. It's going to take political reform, and she doesn't talk much about political reform, about how we would reduce the sway of money, how we would empower broad groups like labor unions to play a more constructive role in our politics again, or how we might make our political system work a little better to represent the majority, because it's so hard now to get things done in Washington.
Do you have a position on TPP, or do you write in the book about the role of free trade in this progression in general? Because we see President Obama still believing that this is better for America rather than bad, and, you know, his concerns generally being aligned with trying to, you know, help people who are not necessarily the 1%. So I don't know how much you go there.
Well, not as much as you might think. And I actually think the trade story is one that has become much more prominent in just the last decade or so. And that's partly because the rise of China has meant that the nature of the competition we're facing from abroad has changed from the era in which it was sort of upstart trading partners like Japan or Germany that were recovering from the war that were our most serious competitors. And, you know, with China, we're dealing with a country that is, as Trump has said, has a history of manipulating its currency and protecting its market, but also is just a country in which there are hundreds of millions of billions, literally, of workers who are willing to work for very low wages, and so it's very hard for manufacturers to compete with that. What I would say is that this is exactly why the sense that the system is rigged is so corrosive. That same poll that I mentioned before showed that most Americans think that trade has been bad for the American economy as a whole. And, even if you have a pessimistic, negative view of trade, overall, I think trade is generally a good thing for an economy. But it requires that you have a political system that figures out how to help people who are indeed disadvantaged by the pressures from foreign competition. You need to have adjustment assistance. You need to have good systems for retraining workers. You need to have a strong social safety net. And so if you don't have that, then people want to, close off the economy altogether. And that's why it's really important that people start to see the political system as representing their broad interests rather than representing, say, multinational corporations who want to have, the most corporation-friendly trade laws, the most corporation-friendly international intellectual property laws. And that's, I think, TPP wasn't really that much about trade. It isn't really that much about trade because trade barriers are relatively low among these nations. It's really about setting the rules of the game for international competition. And a lot of people think that basically those rules are being set by corporations.
Well, tomorrow, folks, we will hear the candidates in their own words on this. In our 30 Issues election series, issue 25, The Economy Is or Isn't Rigged, and analyze the Trump and Clinton positions. One last question first for Jacob Hacker from Yale. I think you're right about that term crony capitalism and how it's being used, don't you?
Absolutely. So you're right to say that for the right, this is a problem of crony capitalism, and for the left, they talk more about plutocracy or oligarchy, the dominance of the rich. And the crony capitalist charge, it's actually, there's a lot of truth to it. That is, there are a lot of areas where we see government bending over backward to help very narrow private interests. Unfortunately for conservatives, it's often areas where they're the ones that are helping out those corporations, such as fighting efforts to reduce global warming, where they're really standing up for the concentrated interests of the energy companies. But I think there's a bigger issue, which is when you say crony capitalism, it suggests that you can have capitalism that doesn't have government involved. And as I've said, and as Paul Pierce and I argue in our book, that's just not possible. So you need to have an effective government. You need to have a strong government to have prosperity. And the real challenge is figuring out how to make sure that government has the ability to act on behalf of broad democratic majorities as opposed to these narrow concentrated interests. And to me, that's what most Americans are concerned about. They really think that the big problem is that government isn't working on behalf of them. And, there's evidence that they're right, and we need to really work to change the system.
Yale politics professor Jacob Hacker, co-author of the new book, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we have a very special guest, Anders Rasmussen, the former prime minister of Denmark and former secretary general of NATO, which has become an issue in the campaign. Stay with us.